Welcome to the Commonwealth Club of California. I'm George Hammond, Chair of the Humanities Forum, which organized tonight's event. I'd like to welcome our audience here in San Francisco and our online and radio audiences. Tonight we have a great and very topical topic, Spying on Democracy with Heidi Boghossian. She is the Executive Director of the National Lawyers Guild and also the author of Spying on Democracy, which goes back and looks into the past 20, 30, 40, 50 years of the kind of spying that we've done in this country on ourselves. And I'd like to start with the idea, you know, you called your book Spying on Democracy. If we were a monarchy or an oligarchy or a dictatorship, do you think that would be different? Because obviously all those governments have spied on their citizens and spied on each other for centuries. Do you think that it should be different in a democracy?
I think the hallmark of a democracy includes a free press, cherished rights such as an attorney-client privilege, the First Amendment right to free association and free expression. And I think the spying apparatus that we've seen develop commensurate with the development of sophisticated technology, which has really accelerated over the last 2 to 3 decades, has called into question and really tested the strength of our democratic institutions. When we start spying on children as they learn to type on a computer keyboard and monitor attorney-client conversations, threaten journalists with the subpoenas or charges of espionage for trying to protect confidential sources, then I think we have to examine where we are right now.
Yeah, that was a great story. I'm going to go right to that on the children. Those of you who have children or grandchildren in school, and this was just fascinating. At Harriton High School, students had no idea what was hidden in the computer laptops that their school had given them. A one-to-one laptop computer initiative, partially funded by state and federal grants, was supposed to implement what the school called an authentic mobile 21st century learning environment. However, in a remarkable display of audacity, school district administrators were remotely activating built-in laptop cameras to watch students' behavior in the privacy of their own homes. I've never heard of anything like that, although I know a lot of places that get these laptops. School officials notified a particular guy's parents that he was engaging in improper behavior at home. It was very discreet of you not to say what it was. When Blake's parents went to school, the administrators showed them a photo taken from the remote camera on his laptop, which they had given him. I think that's just really outrageous. I don't think very many parents think that that's going to happen when they get laptops handed out, but there it is. What's the background on that, and what's happened because of it? Did he win his case?
The school admitted that they stopped the spying, but I believe they refused to admit any liability, as we so often see in some settlements. I think that is an extreme example. I included it to bring attention to the many ways that children are monitored. Another example is bracelets that children wear at amusement parks, specifically Disney World. They're called magic bands. And in them, if the parents and families consent, is an RFID chip, radio frequency identification chip, that holds personal identifying information, such as the child's date of birth, so that it's touted as a way to avoid waiting in long lines to gain entrance to the park. But if your child passes by Cinderella on his or her birthday, the child is greeted by name, and Cinderella says, "Happy birthday." The point of this being that data aggregators and corporations from a very early age seek to befriend and cultivate brand loyalty among children, really before they have the ability to distinguish between fantasy and reality. So that much as on Saturday morning commercials, you'll see animated ads sandwiched between commercial programmings, children don't know the difference, and we're building really a sense of consumerism from an early age, and in exchange, extracting a lot of personal data, often without families knowing. Apps on electronic devices, for example, that children often use that are fun, have tracking devices and other ways of collecting personal information. Mm-hmm. And one of the problems is that the law has not kept abreast with rapid advances in technology. Thanks to several advocacy groups like the Electronic Privacy Information Center, the Electronic Frontier Foundation, we have people trying to urge legislators to be more protective of those really most vulnerable members of our society. But I think that people need to start being aware of how, at an early age, we're being brought into the web of surveillance.
I found it very interesting myself when our daughter was born 13 years ago that 5 months to the date after her birthday, we got something in the mail saying, from Gerber, I think, saying, now it is time to start giving, you know, this kind of food to your child. This is a 5-month birthday. I mean, her grandmothers didn't even remember the 5-month birthday.
But Gerber did. Another example where a father found out through ads that were sent to his daughter from the store Target, they were sending her maternity-related advertisements. This is because they had an analyst tracking her spending habits. I guess she bought calcium, some other products. She was 17 or 18, lived at home, didn't know she was pregnant, so he stormed to the store angrily saying, why are you sending my daughter this, only to find out that indeed she was pregnant.
One way to find out. Now, you mentioned the surveillance that's been done of particular groups, and you went back to the critical mass bicycle activists and animal rights activists. And, you know, when I read it, I thought, you know, these are really not going to disrupt the status quo. These groups are small. Now, Occupy Wall Street, you also mentioned a little bit closer, but these are very minor irritants, if you want to call it that, to the people who run the status quo. Why would they take it so... I'm from the Vietnam protester generation, that and the civil rights generation. That was big, you know, large protests. You can kind of understand why that would get people going. But this is, you know, I was surprised at how much activity there was.
Animal rights and environmental activists, in some people's eyes, are considered fringe elements. They have been very successful over the past several decades in affecting social change, raising social awareness about issues, largely that implicate corporate responsibility and what corporations are doing, either with animal testing or to the environment. And I think that because of their success, in 2005, the FBI deemed them the top domestic terrorist threats. I think the difference between the Vietnam era and now is that after the Cold War, we saw a decline in military spending, and corporations began to repurpose traditional military applications for civilian use. And that was a way for them to inject more money. Texas Instruments, known for calculators, and other corporations started coming up with surveillance technology and computer networks that the government, the NSA, and other intelligence facets of the government rely on to do their business. We've seen a close partnership develop, and that's what I talk largely about, between corporations who, as many may know now, conduct approximately 70% of what were traditionally government intelligence functions, with many problems, no oversight. Obviously, corporations' first duty is to protect their bottom line, to make profit for the shareholders. And I think that in many ways, we've seen corporations serving really as the long arm of law enforcement, getting around the Fourth Amendment to the Constitution, unreasonable searches and seizures, which are prescribed. The government can't do that, but if they work with corporations, the lines blur. So that I think now some of the groups I mentioned, such as bicyclists in New York City, were taking part in monthly critical mass rides and were what we sort of call do-it-yourself questioners of the status quo, be it corporate policies or government policies. Those became threatening, especially to Mayor Bloomberg and others in New York City. And the NY Police Department at the 2004 Republican National Convention loosened what we call the handshoe consent decree, which really put limits on how police could spy on local domestic activists. They publicized in advance of the RNC the fact that violent anarchists were coming to town on the front page of the tabloid newspapers, predicted thousands of arrests. In fact, they did arrest people without probable cause. And what we don't read on the front page of the tabloids is that most of the charges were dropped, and that, in fact, police perjured documentary evidence when they arrested peaceful people on the sidewalks, ran them through the court system, held them up for months, and really vilified individuals engaging in protest. I think that's how some of these groups have been targeted and held up because they speak out against policies that corporations don't want them to object to.
Well, let's try to draw a distinction between maybe America and severe dictatorships. And there's a certain amount of protest, and it seems to me that the gut reaction is always, you know, let's stop these people. These people are dangerous and all that. And over time, say, you know, even during the Vietnam War protests, they eventually said, you know, they started shooting a little bit, killed some people, and then they said, you know, we can actually have 1 million people protest and nothing happens afterwards. We can still have our war. And so, you know, that kind of thing is, they think the reaction is really strong and then we calm down. On the other hand, I'd like to know, do we have political prisoners, you know, that are sitting in jail for 10 years at a time from these protests, or do they mostly get out after that everything gets dropped, after they've rounded everybody, all the usual suspects up, and then let them go again?
Well, I don't think we have that many political protesters as a result of going into the streets. But I think what we do have is what we call a chilling effect on free speech by having police in riot paraphernalia with so-called less lethal weapons. And certainly everyone in this audience is aware of what happened in Oakland at protests, especially during Occupy, which I think really shone a spotlight on how different police departments across the country responded to occupiers. In Oakland, you had a consent decree and prohibitions on how police are supposed to act at First Amendment assemblies, and they broke those agreements. And luckily, there were some lawsuits brought, although we shouldn't have to bring lawsuits, especially when we have procedures in place. But it's costly to monitor police behavior, to bring lawsuits to curb overzealous police activities that really then frighten individuals who may have never gone to a protest before but feel strongly about a policy and want to take to the streets. Now you risk being shot at with a rubber bullet or having tear gas deployed or being falsely arrested and having to go through the system, which is costly, and the settlements that are being paid out for things that are really our basic rights, I think could be diverted elsewhere and better spent on real law enforcement and intelligence gathering.
Well, you had one story about Lynn Stewart, the lawyer that represented Sheikh Abdul Rahman. I happen to take personal interest in that because I was nearly on the jury for his trial. We had jury duty in New York. I was in New York at the time, and we all got called in. I thought, this will take me 3 hours, and I'll be out. And we walked in, and there was security everywhere. And they marched us between rooms, between flanks of guards. And I said, what are we being asked to come in for? And very fortunately, the judge said something very stupid in front of all of our pool of jurors. And so, you know, none of us could do it. But he walked into the room, and the judge said, well, we all know he's guilty. Something stupid like that, I mean. So anyway, we all got out of that jury duty, but that was a trial that lasted a year and a half, and I didn't particularly want to do that. So in any case, she is in jail now as a result of her representation of him later on. You want to tell that story?
Lynn Stewart is a longtime criminal defense attorney. She's now been disbarred, but she practiced in New York City. She had been a school teacher. She represented a lot of politically active individuals, including the so-called, some of the Central Park jogger defendants, Sammy the Bull Gravano. And she was one of the appointed attorneys on the Sheikh, so-called the Blind Sheikh's case, who was convicted for trying to destroy landmarks, including the World Trade Center, in 1993. To see her client in a maximum security facility, she had to sign what's called a special administrative measure, a SAM. And basically that said that she could not communicate on behalf of her client to the outside world. He was in maximum security. And this was during the Clinton administration. She issued a press release at one point saying that the Sheikh had changed his mind on a certain policy, a ceasefire agreement. And what happened was Janet Reno, who was Attorney General under Clinton, said, don't do it again, you violated the SAM. But it wasn't a criminal action, it was a procedural administrative violation. So she got sort of a slap on the wrist, kept representing the Sheikh. When Bush became president and Attorney General John Ashcroft came in, they decided to indict Lynn on the very fact that she'd violated the SAM. And Ashcroft traveled to New York, appeared on the David Letterman show to announce the indictment, and said, here, this is the first case of an attorney being prosecuted for aiding terrorism by releasing a press release. We felt in the National Lawyers Guild and in the progressive legal community this was sending a strong signal. She was, in effect, the poster child of an attorney who represented politically active or controversial clients. And it was saying, beware, you can be brought up on terrorism charges. Now, her trial, this was around 2002, took place in the federal courtroom blocks away from Ground Zero. And the state brought in photos, mention of Osama bin Laden, things that really had nothing to do with the case. She was convicted. Many of the jurors cried when they convicted her. But there was such an outpouring of support, hundreds of letters from a wide range of individuals whom she'd represented or whose lives she'd touched in one way or another. And the judge sentenced her, I think it was 18 months. The government came back and said, this wasn't harsh enough, you departed from the guidelines, and he, Judge John Kodal, resentenced her to 10 years, where she's now in a medical facility because she has terminal cancer and other illnesses in Texas. There's a campaign underway to grant compassionate release. The warden recommended it. The Federal Department of Corrections denied it once. The paperwork is now sitting again on Samuels, the head of corrections, desk. And she doesn't have long to live. Meanwhile, the guidelines for granting compassionate release have actually been made more lenient, so that I think there's an increasing awareness that too many elderly people in prison are dying. She just wants to come home to be with her family. But her case is highly political because it shows that two administrations can quite differently treat an administrative violation, and one raises it to the level of a terrorism charge.
Yep. It's great to bring that information out. I thought it was a great part of the book. So to try to look at it from yet another point of view, you have a little section here on a break-in for justice that I'd like to read. On March 8, 1971, in a stealth move that laid bare a brazen government intent on silencing free speech and dissent, the Citizens Commission to Investigate the FBI broke into the FBI's resident agency in Media, Pennsylvania. The raiders took approximately 1,000 classified documents that showed aggressive spying and disruption of politically active groups and individuals. The files detailed the ways that FBI agents provoked U.S. citizens to commit unlawful activities to justify harsh police responses, etc. So the point I wanted to make about this is a form of spying on the government. It's breaking in and stealing their things. And so I was wondering if you think that the government shouldn't have the right to spy on us, but we need the right to break in and get theirs, get their information.
Throughout our history, acts of civil disobedience have taken place by courageous individuals who at the time put their lives on the line, and for the most part who we look at decades later and call heroes. I believe those individuals were heroes because they exposed COINTELPRO, the counterintelligence programs under J. Edgar Hoover, that targeted lawful activities of people like Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., religious, political leaders, anti-war activists, and exposed what many believe is an overreaching government, one where J. Edgar Hoover saw enemies everywhere and collected dossiers on high-profile individuals that really, I think, frightened a lot of presidents and others because they knew he had information on them. But what happened that is relevant now is that public outrage was so great that a commission was convened, named after Frank Church, the Church Committee, and they looked into COINTELPRO and decided that the programs were illegal. They violated the Constitution, and they put in place the Attorney General guidelines that limited FBI spying on domestic dissidents and religious groups and others. The practices during COINTELPRO were dirty, meant to disrupt organizations, not just to spy on them, but to go in and destroy them. And during that time, we had a lot of illegal army spying on student campuses in the 60s and 70s, amassing files on individuals. And I think why this is important to remember is that we look to our citizens to be the watchdog arm of the government at times of so-called national crisis, when we see too often the national security argument invoked as a necessity. And there is no exception to the Fourth Amendment. There is no national security exception to the Fourth Amendment. And we don't have to choose between our safety and our civil liberties. I think that we have leakers, Ed Snowden and many others, who were filling the kind of role that those individuals played back then, because they see a government and an executive branch especially that is overreaching in its power. We had a Supreme Court case in the early 70s, U.S. v. U.S. District Court, that Arthur Kanoy and several attorneys from the Center for Constitutional Rights and the National Lawyers Guild brought. And the Supreme Court held that the president isn't above the law, can't wiretap and listen in on its citizens without probable cause. And one of the problems that we've seen over the last decades is the erosion of things like the Attorney General guidelines that place limits on spying on lawful individuals.
I think some of the people in this audience that I recognize have probably heard Seth Rosenfeld when I had him come here in February for the book Subversives, which talked all about how Ronald Reagan came to power and that old background with FBI. You had a very interesting idea in your book, which was that the current being a debtor nation, the fact that we're a debtor nation, has made us more nervous. And being more nervous, maybe we are more insecure, and being more insecure, maybe that's why we're spying on ourselves a little bit more. And I thought that was an interesting idea. What made you think that that was probably one of the outcomes of the financial issues?
Well, I think a couple of factors are at play. We have relied on and seen since, I think, right before the Reagan administration, what I call manufactured wars on ideology, such as the war on drugs. Now we have the war on terror. I think when a nation becomes insecure, whether it's financially or in other respects, we see campaigns of propaganda that really prey on individuals' fears of the day, be it another terrorist attack or the hype really that Nixon brought with advertisements against black communities, portraying them in commercial advertisements as drug-ridden. Your women should be afraid to walk out at night. We have an enormous prison industrial complex that is really, along with the so-called school-to-prison pipeline, where young children are being punished for just being children sometimes, acting out in school, handcuffed, arrested. An overly punitive society that can't deal, I think, rationally with problems, be they economic, social. And so what we do is we punish harshly, put people away, take away the idea of incarceration as rehabilitation, have it purely punishment, and then have to fortify, now with the war on terror, big business and a revolving door between the private sector and the government, so that we have a high percentage of 3- and 4-star retired generals now working in private surveillance or defense companies, contractors, who then advise the government on policy that, of course, benefits them, such as the drone lobby, bringing biometrics, drones, other formerly military applications such as RFID chips into our general population, into our everyday lives. We've become a militarized society, I think because the kind of, you know, common sense analysis that used to inform our government and the policies that we created to make our society really one that valued human rights has been eroded greatly. And I think that right now we see a race to gather as much information, as much data, to sort of harness the internet, which was created really to be a road for democracy and open communication. We see restrictive laws, people such as Jeremy Hammond, who's a hacker facing 10 years in prison on a plea deal, Barrett Brown, who's in Texas facing 105 years for essentially uploading a computer link, but he had made the connection between corporations working with the government and spying on a lot of activists. These people have become the enemies of the government because they think that information should be free. And I think with increasing classified information under the Obama administration and harsh punishments all around, we have to look at who is controlling information and what they do with that. The potential for abuse, as with any technology, is especially ripe.
Does it surprise you that the Obama administration has not peeled back but has actually pushed forward in this area?
I think it surprised many people because we have a constitutional scholar who promised change and hope for many. But I think what it shows really is how beholden anyone in the administration is to large multinational corporations who helped get him in office. And I'm hopeful that with the recent revelations and the information that I think is going to continue to unfold, thanks to computer hackers, leakers, whistleblowers, who Obama also promised to protect but in fact has been very harsh on, again, courageous people who throughout our history have put their lives on the line because they see the government acting in unlawful ways. And we owe a debt of gratitude to those individuals.
Now, go back just to go back just a little bit, you mentioned about how the corporations after the Cold War and also after probably World War II as well, had a sort of vacuum and had to fill it with something and went into these technological areas. It reminded me of Cyrus the Great with his army of 3 million men that conquered this great empire, and then he made the mistake of saying, well, I conquered this whole empire, and he disbanded the army. Then he had 3 million men with nothing to do who caused, you know, havoc all over his empire. So maybe creating this vacuum with all these institutions, they have to fill that thing. I mean, do you think that there's any basis to that, that they just had nothing else to do or to keep all their people employed? Or?
I think that the factors, and I think 9/11 really was a catalyst for actually permitting the USA Patriot Act, which had essentially been written before those events, to be hastily pushed through, read by few legislators, again, preying on what we call sort of moral panics. You see it when laws are created after a child has been abducted or something that really offends the sensibility of the public. Legislators rush in to say, I'm harsh on crime. We had that with 9/11, and I think the apparatus really was in place, and businesses have built a technology that's installed everywhere, be it in ATM machines, which watch you with cameras, to, you know, motion detecting, all sorts of equipment that may seem futuristic, but that is being justified because we have a vague, amorphous ideological enemy, and a number of unlawful, attacks and invasions on other countries. Doing that in the name of empire, of course, but I think because corporations are such a part of our life, with the Supreme Court decisions that have given them so much rights, First Amendment rights, and I think it's irreconcilable, really, to have profit-making entities dictating how we live our lives. But I think definitely there's a great supply and demand, and these corporations and their CEOs wield such enormous influence over our administration that really doesn't know what they're doing, and they keep justifying with so-called terror threats in local communities the need for Department of Homeland Security funding and other grants to fortify their police departments and their surveillance apparatus. So that's why we have the broad anarchist threat, which is very popular these days, because anyone who goes to a protest, wears black, or questions the status quo can be easily labeled an anarchist in the media, and that arouses fears in others who think, well, this is a person who's out to cause violence or harm. In fact, most of these are very community-oriented individuals who I see to be extremely responsible and socially conscious.
One of the ideas that we were just discussing about the insecurity of the current time from a financial point of everything is the flip side of an idea that we've discussed in our series, which is that it's during a time when a culture is very confident that they will become tolerant, that they will open up, and it seems like there was a lot of openings in the 60s and 70s and 80s, women, civil rights, everything kind of shifted during the time, sort of as after the World War II situation, the United States knew we were on top of the world, we were feeling good about it, and so we did this. Do you think that in this insecurity that we could move in the direction of losing some of that opening?
One development I like to mention is the creation of the Federalist Society in, I think, 1982. And the Federalist Society is a group of conservative members. John Roberts, when he was being considered for Supreme Court, many newspapers reported he'd been a member because his name was listed in their leadership directory for a couple of years when he was at a law firm in D.C., and members of the Federalist Society made the newspapers print retractions saying he wasn't a member. He said he had no recollection of it. It started, I believe, at Yale Law School as a way to counter what many conservative lawyers and members of the legal community thought was too much of a trend toward liberalism in our educational institutions and in society. And there's a book that Professor Michael Avery and a colleague wrote a few months ago called The Federalist Society. And it talks about how they've mentored a new generation of young attorneys, heavily funded by foundations like the Olin Foundation, I think the Heritage Foundation, and individuals who do it very, very quietly, but with the goal really of repealing a lot of the remnants of the New Deal enactments and writing amicus or friend of the court briefs, holding thousands of educational debates, even with liberals across the country, but not really putting their name on a lot. And we have, I think half of the Supreme Court has or are members of the Federalist Society. They get young lawyers jobs in government. Ed Meese played a big role in that. They get them federal judicial clerkships and put forth a lot of cases before the Supreme Court that really will change a lot of the basic economic rights, property takings, states' rights. And I think that, over the last three decades, has had an enormous impact on the shift from a more liberal to a more conservative legal landscape and political landscape. I think that's been a huge factor, aided with deregulation under Reagan and subsequent pretty terrifying laws under Clinton that often pass through stealthily with little public input. And then we look back and we see where we are. And so I think that there's been a shift, but I still don't think it's too late to reclaim some of the rights and some of the freedoms that we hold so dear.
Yeah. Speaking of which, how about the drones? Where do you think that they are going? I mean, it's kind of hard for somebody to avoid having such a cool toy to play with, especially locally in your own backyard.
Drones, what fascinates me is that Johns Hopkins University and many other educational institutions are researching. Johns Hopkins is looking into how butterflies fly, because there are two goals. Well, there are probably many more, but two goals are to make unmanned aerial vehicles, UAVs, drones, miniature, some the size of mosquitoes, I've read, and to have them be able to hover in the air for extended periods of time. They can already do that. And of course, as again, with most technological developments, there are positive uses for drones. They can go above a fire or into a dangerous zone where you don't put a person's life at risk. But the idea of having a mosquito-shaped drone and the Federal Aviation Administration admitting that the main reason they want to have more drones in the sky after being pressured by the lobbyists is for law enforcement purposes, and that involves surveillance. So can you imagine a mosquito coming into a New York City or San Francisco congested area and flying into your apartment unbeknownst to you, being able to hover for a few days and have a sophisticated micro camera or laser device that can really track you over an extended period of time? That calls into question really the nature of an unreasonable government search and seizure. Because right now, certainly we know that an aircraft can go above an open plane or can view you in a public place, but we may not know to what extent these will be deployed into our private homes.
Mm-hmm. Something to look forward to.
And the regulation just hasn't kept up. The technology is coming too fast. Permission to deploy them above civilian skies. We don't have the precautions and the safeguards set in place.
With that kind of scenario, it's a nice place to step back and say, okay, I know that you're mostly focused on what's going on in the United States. If you took all the spy agencies that developed after World War II and all of the different affairs that they've had in all the other countries, all the different things that they've put in place and everything, if you had to analyze it, and I know you don't have all the information, but your gut feeling would be that this has improved, this has been to the United States' advantage, just as a totally amoral situation. Has this been serving our interest, or has it both short and long term? Or has it actually undercut our interests more often than it served the interests?
I think that for a period of time, the government would say it served our interests. I think now, when our allied nations are finding out that we're spying on them, when Al Jazeera and other media outlets, AP reporters, and people around the globe are finding out that we're spying on them, it undercuts our credibility. And I think that's why the Obama administration really has been caught off guard and embarrassed by the things that Edward Snowden and The Guardian have brought out. So I think in terms of diplomatic relations, it has not helped us. Now, every nation spies, we all know that. But I think there's something to be said for a government that conducts its intelligence, but at least domestically tries to abide by the constitutional strictures that we've set in place, so that we can have, as Mike German, a former FBI agent who now works for the ACLU, guidelines by which FBI and other law enforcement agents can open an investigation on an American, but it should really be predicated on facts that the agent can articulate that a judge or an impartial magistrate approves before doing so. The problem we have now, we heard recently about Project Hemisphere, a covert program where the government pays AT&T agents to sit with drug enforcement agents and give them access to AT&T records dating back 26 years. How did we find out about this? A young activist named Drew in Washington State was requesting Freedom of Information Act documents, and by mistake, information about Project Hemisphere was included in that. One of the great problems with this is that there's no warrant for AT&T to look at those records. It's done by way of an administrative subpoena, a piece of paper that the Drug Enforcement Agency has someone sign off on, which begs the question, how many other government agencies are using administrative subpoenas? Mm-hmm. Just as we're finding out the many problems with the FISA court searches, it seems that all the systems we had in place, safeguards, are being ignored. And I think that there's a way to pull back, put some of those restrictions in place, because I was going to say, Mike German says, as an FBI agent, a former agent, when you don't have guidelines, you run the risk that agents will use their own subjective beliefs to deem someone a problem and open an investigation. Now all they need to do is say they had, I think it's good faith belief that it warranted opening an investigation, and that's simply not good enough.
Yeah. Do you think that, this trend is influenced partially by the lack of interest in personal privacy that's come in the computerized generation? I mean, the give up of a great deal of privacy and or the expectation of privacy?
I think technology has advanced so quickly, really exponentially, with the internet and in the intervening years, that as a nation that loves its gadgets, of course we've been intrigued, mesmerized, and addicted to our personal devices. So what I think we need to do is take a look at how we want to control the information that is made available to us. One of the problems with the so-called gathering of metadata is that associations can be inferred by the government by who you call. Say you call a cancer clinic or you buy a book on cancer. They can assume maybe you have cancer. Another danger with this data collection is storage and how someone can access it and change your health records or your personal financial information or manipulate it. We don't know. The amount of information collected on you contains such a high rate of inaccuracy, and you have no way of knowing it or correcting it. And government officials admit this. So I think the question is how to take the good uses of technology, but also restore the fundamental rights that we really, on which this country was founded, and say we have a responsibility as people to hold the government in check and to say we don't like certain invasions of privacy. It is difficult because so many young people were raised on technology and may not understand the long-term consequences right now. But I think, as I say with the notion of, for people who say I've never protested, I'm not interested, I have nothing to hide. Well, I would ask, do you want to live in a country where if your neighbor had a serious injustice perpetrated against him or her, a family member who might have been, you know, poisoned by toxic water and wants to fight that, do you want to live in a nation where that person can't speak out? We have to start looking at human examples, real-life stories, and try to replace, I think, in-person community with the propaganda that corporate America is trying to give us. You know, no more mom-and-pop stores, all Starbucks. I don't want to live in a society where I can't pick and avail the services of a human being and a family business.
Mm-hmm. Well, I know it won't give away the ending if I read the last line. All who resist are the custodians of democracy. That's the last one. So I have several more questions, but I'd like to open it up to the audience to ask questions. So we have mics, and if you can come up to the mic so that it can be recorded, that'd be just great. Otherwise, it won't get recorded, and the other mic will come around here, and the mic over there. So you just thanks. Go ahead.
I just first of all want to thank you so much for an absolutely fabulous talk. I'm here with a very dear colleague, and we've been going to any number of different groups, meetings, Restore the Fourth Committee, Civil Rights Committee at the Unitarian Church. There's probably 10 different groups that are springing up in response to what the government's doing. I just want to ask two things. Do you see as a solution, for instance, the states' rights positions and communities and municipalities passing legislation to say, for instance, we don't agree to indefinite detention, we don't agree to the government's exertion of an overreach into privacy via the Patriot Act? And secondarily, for example, something that's coming up rapidly in Oakland called the Urban Shield, this has been a significant learning curve for me. I'm also from New York, and I had no idea what was going on in Oakland. I learned just the other day was, for example, 2 years ago, or approximately 2 years ago, evidently the law enforcement agencies in Oakland had reached out to the Israeli something like SWAT teams to give advice, sophisticated advice to the police department, something that's coming up soon in Oakland called the Urban Shield. They're using advanced military techniques on civilian populations during peacetime in, needless to say, poor urban areas. With such focus and overreach, that it is truly shocking. So I'm just wondering if you could comment on what you think the solutions are and how to stop the United Stasi, which seems to be coming down.
The question was, in sum, can community organizations and people, are measures that they may take effective in, I think, rolling back some of the really frightening militaristic developments that we're seeing. I would say that, again, the National Lawyers Guild has been around 76 years. We do litigation advocacy and believe that litigation is very important to change some of the infractions that we see, but it has to be coupled with a strong people's movement in the streets. I say that metaphorically and practically because, and I think also lawsuits can be brought. A wonderful book by Jules Lobel is called Success Without Victory, and it talks about the importance of bringing lawsuits on issues as significant as the ones we're facing now. Issues such as slavery, secret detention, all the issues the audience member mentioned, because in addition to bringing them into a courtroom, one has to bring these issues into the public social forum and raise awareness, have news coverage, spark a debate. I list examples of school children who have refused to show their palm to have it scanned to get into the high school cafeteria for lunch. Or community in California that fought the city council, said they didn't want to have a domestic surveillance drone. School children who say, I don't want my ID to have a radio frequency ID chip in it, which many schools in California and Texas are now using to keep track. They say it's to justify to funders, attendance rates, that, again, as with many arguments, makes things go faster. A doctor may ask you for a palm scan to see the doctor faster in a hospital. I know in New York they're doing that. But I certainly don't want to have my palm scanned to get into a cafeteria, and I do call these people heroes, mm-hmm. these people who are brave enough to take a public stand. I think we all need to do that. We need to work with community. If you don't want to get actively involved, we have a number of wonderful groups around the country that are doing this work. Support them in any way you can. But again, bring out the human stories of things that you see that you don't like. Word of mouth is still an extremely popular mode of communication, whether it be in person or online. Let's use the internet and our in-person communities to remind ourselves that we're only as strong as our human networks are, and that we can be creative, innovative. If we want to protest, let's find a symbolic way to draw attention and to raise awareness. And I see that we have a great activist, Gloria LaRiva, up at the microphone.
Thank you so much for a great book, a great presentation, and everything you do, Heidi, for people's rights. I want to ask you about the issue of habeas corpus, and it's not about the spine, my question, but most people in this country don't realize how our rights to appeal have been severely limited by the Clinton Law of 1996, the effective death penalty, anti-terrorism. And the fact that most people don't know about this, or that in the 90s, I think it was, federal life imprisonment meant life imprisonment, no parole at all. Do you think there's a chance for a reform on this or turning this back?
I always think there's a chance for reform. We're seeing, I think, and I mentioned the instance of Lynn Stewart and the laws changing vis-a-vis compassionate release. I met a couple of individuals in New York recently who are working on the issue of the number of elderly persons who are incarcerated, again, because of our overly harsh and long sentences. We have now a whole strata of society who's dying in prison. The chances of recidivism are extremely low, and I think it calls into the question our humanity as a nation. So I think, and Michelle Alexander's The New Jim Crow wonderful book has really also drawn attention to the notion of the mass incarceration epidemic. But I think things get so bad that people who may not have really been aware of these different epidemics will start to hopefully say, this is not the country that we once thought it was. And I hope that sparks some changes. I think, you know, in the last few weeks, Obama has said they're going to relook at some of the ways they've been punishing journalists and roll back a little bit on that. So I think, again, I think the administration is embarrassed with many of the policies that are coming to light, and I do think that people are starting to wake up and say, we don't want this. So I'm hopeful.
I heard Jerry Brown speak when he was mayor of Oakland back in 2001 on his State of the City address. And one of the things that he said, he was telling about how they were dealing with recidivists and people that came back on parole and how they had to deal with them. And he said, you know, we've tried all kinds of things and nothing seems to work. But I would predict something. If you just dealt with these people between the ages of 14 and 44 and then just started ignoring them after the age of 44, that we probably wouldn't have much trouble with them after they're 44. It's mostly
and most other countries don't incarcerate people the length of time, and certainly not the elderly. They let them go.
Let them go, yeah. I'd like to remind our radio and online audiences that they're listening to Conversation with Heidi Bogosian, the author of Spine on Democracy and the executive director of the National Lawyers Guild. Next question.
Yes, the reforms that we're getting some, or the areas where we seem to be getting some positive turnaround, all right, appear to be fringe in relation to the big picture, the whole enchilada, the run silent, run deep, corporate America, the military, industrial, financial complex, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Very powerful. The economic pillars of the infrastructure have been put into place, you know, for 100 years. Are we not just playing out something that to get the magnitude of the reform that we need, can you see that happening without violence?
See it happening without?
Violence.
Oh. I do think we're entrenched. I think this perpetual war paradigm and the quest really to continue to preserve our status as the world power is a difficult one. I would say that people try different tactics based on what they feel comfortable with. I get a lot of questions at the Guild from people who maybe have not engaged in civil disobedience before. And we always say, whatever your comfort level is, you have to be the one who decides. And I know that it is going to take something momentous to shake up this entrenched state that we're in.
I mean, just from a historical perspective, if you look at the major paradigm shifts, have any of them really happened without some level of mass revolt, revolution, as being a significant core piece?
Right. Yes, you're right. And I think that it's instructive to look at what happened with Occupy, which really caught on so quickly and yet was so quickly stifled by law enforcement and other agencies in this country. So I would say that you have an excellent point. We'll see.
I can think of a few things that have changed because of ideas. A new idea comes in, the idea takes hold, people get really excited about the idea shifts. So there are some things that are done without violence. And I also would have to say, if you just look at Egypt, over the last couple of years, there was plenty of violence, and what happened? I think if you analyze the history of revolution, you will find a fairly small percentage that ended up being positive outcomes at the end of it. But that doesn't mean that it can't be used, but I just think it's a last resort.
Well, yeah, it appears that unfortunately it takes the path of revolution instead of evolution. Thank you.
Either that or a comet that destroys half the planet. That helps evolution really well. Then at least no one has to take responsibility for it.
I have to tell you, as a Vietnam veteran, I can't tell you how offended I am by the direction this country has taken. I'm just absolutely stunned. And, you know, when I put my life on the line, you know, I thought I was doing it for democracy. And I more and more understand that I did it for the 1%. And the kind of things we see at the Supreme Court now, going to decide to take Citizens United and expand it 1,000-fold. And those arguments are going to be held at 6th or October 8th. 1 out of 4 people in prison on the planet are in this country. I mean, you know, are we genetically predisposed towards criminality? I mean, you know, it's just the facts speak for themselves. And I wonder about the psychological effect. I mean, spying on democracy, I always think of a democracy as being a place where people have a certain level of soul awareness and options that enhances creativity that we see manifest. And what is going to be the long-term effect on people who have no privacy? No privacy whatsoever.
I think that the loss of creativity, personal autonomy, is tragic. And a friend of mine in the East Village in New York has opened a little museum to try to preserve the history of squatters there, community gardens. And he's always telling me that it's the Europeans who come over and take the weekly tours they give who were very enlightened and appreciate that history. But a lot of the people in our own community don't even know what a squat was or understand the notion of a community fighting to keep a small plot of garden open. I think it's very important for the veterans who have served this country. As you mentioned, there's a film on the Occupy movement, and two of the most compelling figures in that film, one is a veteran and the other is a law enforcement officer who decided to get arrested because he saw what was happening. And I think that people, again, we have stereotypes in this country about protesters. I think it's really important to try to break through those stereotypes and not let the government tell us who, you know, not relegate free speech zones as they do in little barbed wire enclosures far away from a gathering. Not dictate what patriotism is. And I think that any of us who see an injustice and who've served the country in one way or another or who pay our taxes has a right to say, we hate this, this is not America, and you can't do this in our name. But I still feel hopeful that, again, speaking out in whatever format, whatever tactic people want to use, we have to try everything.
And I'd also like to say that we humans are very tenacious. I lived in the Soviet Union for one summer in 1973. There was a total, not total lack of privacy, but much more than we've gotten to. And they lived for 70 years under that, and then they came out, and they were still very human. So I don't think there's anything that can squelch our basic humanity. It's just a question of how much we want squelched and for how long. It just can't be done. We have time for one last question, if someone would like to ask it. I see somebody going up.
It seems possible, isn't it? Layers of the onions keep getting peeled with things coming out weekly in The Guardian and different places, that even some strong security folks down the street here, Senator Dianne Feinstein, is backing up a little bit on her support of this, but that's unknown. But I was wondering about, with the massive amount of data being stored at the Utah Data Center and their idea that they can go retroactively 10 or 12 years past from now to sort things out for things that they haven't looked at yet, it seemed like at the very least, you know, one of these streams could be slowed by some law or agreement, if not, you know, just to placate people for a while, and then that could be a crack in the door to slow down the train. Well, not a good analogy, but...
Right. Yeah, for people who don't know, there's an enormous data center being built in Utah. James Bamford, who's written The Shadow Factory and who kind of exposed a lot of what the NSA is doing years ago, wrote a great article in Wired about it. You know, it's because we lack the capacity, they want to collect so much data, they have to build new centers. I think, and the danger, obviously, is we have so many laws on the books that people who say, I'm not doing anything wrong, are deluding themselves if they think this government can't find something that you're doing wrong, especially on the computer with the strict ways that they have of sort of punishing how we use information and access it. But I think that's an excellent point. We have to look at all creative strategies, be it legal, creative civil disobedience. And I think that, you know, to be able to retroactively go in and perhaps punish something we did 15 years ago or find that certain behaviors may fall into disfavor. Look, we right now use antiquated laws. Clever prosecutors can dig up an old law in the books that might never have been used but is still there. So lawyers should think creatively. People should come up with ideas, write about them. I think that's, as you say, we can't really be totally squelched, and our strength is in creativity and humanity, and some of the best court battles have been won on really innovative ideas.
Thank you very much, Heidi.
Thank you.
Thank you for a great talk. So ends another event at the Commonwealth Club in its 111th year of enlightened discussion. Thank you very much for coming.